It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Milwaukee-based designer creates her clothing line out of discarded t-shirts, makes new fabrics out of scraps, and says you too can make use of old clothing and find sustainable fashion options. We'll learn more about fast versus slow fashion coming up. First, a new national report from the Urban Institute is shedding light on a mismatch between people's education levels and the requirements for the jobs they're seeking. In short, a lot of people are overqualified, at least when it comes to education. The report also says Milwaukee and Madison have a lot more job seekers with degrees than jobs that require those degrees. Chemaine Mills is a reporter with Wisconsin Public Radio. She's been covering this new report. Chemaine, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, there's a lot of different kind of reporting on jobs and employment and unemployment. What did this particular report try to tackle?
Well, you summed it up pretty well. There's a lot of educated people out there and not necessarily a lot of jobs that require the education they got. And the report looked at various levels of education, those with a college degree that included bachelor's all the way up to a PhD. And of course, you had more of those people in college towns like Madison and Milwaukee. And then it also looked at other post-secondary education, associate's degrees, and some college. So in all the areas looked at, there were over 300 metro areas looked at. There was a mismatch between 1 and 32. So it varied how much of a difference there was between the applicant's knowledge and skills and the jobs available.
Right. It seems like, though, it was a general trend around the country that in most cases there weren't as many jobs requiring that college degree as there were job seekers or employees having the college degree. Is that fair to say?
Right. And that's a problem because people spend a lot of money, a lot of time getting an education, and there is no assurance that there will be a job waiting when you're completed with your degree.
Now, on the other hand, there's been a lot of debate along those lines. Is it worth it to get that degree? As we know from other reports, the people with the higher levels of education do end up generally in jobs that pay more, right?
Right. Not only that, but the Association of Public and Land Grant Universities says people with degrees are less likely to be unemployed, and they make about $1 million in additional earnings on average over their lifetime.
Over the entire career. So
right.
Part of what's happening then, if I'm doing the math correctly, it must be that some of these people with education after high school, because this is people with some college or college degrees or more, are ending up in jobs that don't have those requirements. They're ending up in those jobs that require high school or higher education.
Right. And there's a cascade effect. It not only impacts them, but people who may not have a degree are bumped out of a job for which they're only qualified. In other words, those going to lower skilled jobs are bumping out, taking the place of others.
Talking to Chemaine Mills, reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio, looking at a new report from the Urban Institute on a mismatch between the educational levels of job seekers and the jobs out there. In general, a lot of jobs don't require higher education beyond high school, but a lot more people have those. So what ends up happening? So let's turn to some of the specific areas they looked at in Wisconsin. You said 300 and some around the country. A few of them were, of course, here in Wisconsin. What did we learn?
Well, as we talked about earlier, Madison and Milwaukee, because they churn out so many graduates, there aren't a similar number of jobs that are appropriate for these people. So, and you often have younger people want to be in more metropolitan, cosmopolitan areas, and that's where most of the jobs are, but not as many jobs as there are people with those skills.
So yeah, there are a lot of employers that do require that college degree. It's just that still doesn't match up with that that degree factory in effect coming out of UW's Madison and Milwaukee.
Exactly. But you do see a better match in like Green Bay or Beloit Janesville. Someone with a college degree is more likely to get a job that suits them there. You have less of the gap between jobs available and the applicants.
Now, in addition to looking at the report and getting quotes from the authors of the report themselves, you talked to an economist who looks at these issues here in Wisconsin. What kinds of things did you learn there?
Well, I talked to Matthias Scaglione, who's at the Wisconsin Center for Economic Research, and he actually said the Urban Institute report may be worse than it indicates, because that report looked at population. He said the way to do it is to look at how many people with a certain degree participate in the workforce. And if you have a college degree, you have a very high participation rate in the workforce, whereas those with a high school diploma or some college may have a lower participation rate. So it's kind of disturbing to think that it could be actually worse. But
now, you looked at the report a little more closely than I did. Was there any kind of look at not just how much education, but the kind of education? I didn't see that, because there's been talk about skills gap and we need more people with particular kinds of, say, technical education. Did they address that at all?
No, it didn't really look at that. But the author of the report said a lot of our training is done by the employer, but there needs to be more so they can get some of that training on the job, so there isn't this skills gap.
Right, and the skills gap is a topic that's come up a lot, especially in the last few years, I think it's fair to say, here in Wisconsin. Is this just, this report, maybe one piece of the puzzle in Wisconsin as people try to figure out how to solve that, what some people say is a skills gap problem?
Right. This talks about the skills gap, and the author of the report said it's not only those at the lower end of the education level, it's at the higher end too. And Molly Scott, the author of the report, said there's a lot of untapped ability out there that communities can use. We just have to figure out how to match the two up.
Right. So this report, it laid out a lot of numbers and looked at a lot of communities. Did they start to point toward solutions, ways to close this mismatch between education and the jobs available?
Well, it's a matter of looking or anticipating what jobs are out there, which isn't always easy to
right.
do.
You can't always predict the economic future.
Right, right. I mean, for instance, we heard of healthcare jobs are where it's at. Well, by the time you finish your degree or training, those jobs may have been filled. So it's a matter of not only trying to anticipate what jobs are going to be in the profession you're studying for, and calculating the risk of, you know, how much it costs for an education and what you want to do.
And a question we touched on briefly earlier, the idea of, well, is it worth it for that graduating high school student to go out and pay for and work for that degree? Did this report really try, did it answer that personal question for people, or did it remain agnostic on that issue?
No, it didn't get into that very thorny area. But like we said earlier, there have been studies showing the more education you get, the more likely you are to have a job that's going to pay more over the course of your lifetime.
We'll leave it there. Shemaine, thanks for bringing us up to date on this.
You bet.
Shemaine Mills is a reporter at Wisconsin Public Radio. We talked to her about a new report showing a mismatch between people's education levels and the requirements for jobs they're seeking. If that's you, if you feel like you're working in a job that didn't require the education you got, love to hear your story. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up, what's more important to you when buying clothes? That it's cheap but trendy or fits well and might last a long time? For people who want to be stylish on a budget, those cheap, fast fashion options on the market can be appealing. But a Milwaukee designer says there are many more sustainable options available to us. Find out how today on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report from the New York Times documents the impact of pregnancy discrimination on women in the workplace. We'll talk to one of the lead reporters on that story. Right now, if you've ever shopped for clothes at stores like H&M, Topshop, Forever 21, even Target, you've probably been a consumer of what's called fast fashion. That's clothing that takes the latest fashion trends and gets them on store shelves cheaply and quickly. But our next guest says that fast fashion comes with a lot of downsides for the environment, for workers, and for consumers. She makes the case for slow fashion and more sustainable clothing. Vanessa Andrew is a Milwaukee artist, community educator, and expert at reusing old materials to make something new. She designs and creates clothing and textiles and has her own brand, Madame Chino, which she started in 2003. Vanessa, welcome to Central Time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Let's start off with this idea of fast fashion. It's a phrase I've heard, but I don't know what it means. Could you just give us a 101 when we say the words fast fashion? What is that?
Yeah, absolutely. So fast fashion is made quick, and it's consumed quick, and it's thrown away. It's not durable, so it doesn't last very long. It's made by forced or underpaid workers in poor working conditions, and there are huge environmental impacts both in conception, production, and disposal.
Yeah, let's dig into a couple of those points before we move on to the sustainable side of things. First of all, the environmental concerns. This is something that has people worried about, I guess, the chain from how it's made to how it's disposed of.
Absolutely, and I think that was my first concern and what brought my interest to this field. I mean, there's tons of water use from the crops to washing, creating the fibers and, you know, dyeing this fabric. You've got the fossil fuels and all the pollution involved in, you know, the production and the transportation. A lot of times one garment has multiple facets to it that have to be transported and then brought to the store. And then once you're disposing of it, it goes somewhere else, which is more transportation. A lot of the countries that are producing this stuff have lower environmental standards, so those pollution is going directly into the environment unchecked. And then you think about the waste that we're creating. I have some statistics on the Goodwill. One just right on the north side of Milwaukee, they're receiving 160 donations a day, both large and small. I was shocked to discover they are able to process 800 boxes, 5 by 5 by 5 foot. They're actually getting rid of those boxes every month, and that stuff crushes down to about 6 to 8 bales a day, which each bale is 5 of those 5 by 5 foot boxes in one, and they're worth $50, and they weigh about a ton, and that our local southwestern Wisconsin hub is receiving 200 of those bales a day from our region.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and a lot of this stuff is ending up in other countries, and I think we're really thinking, oh, this is charity, like it's going to a good place, but they're trying to create this ban in East Africa on this stuff because it actually is inhibiting their countries from setting up their own manufacturing. So even the waste part of it, not just that it's going in the garbage, but that it, you know, it's not always going to the needy, and that the needy are, you know, they want to start their own production as well. So that's just kind of eye-opening.
And briefly, before we move on to sustainable fashion, you mentioned concerns about the labor. And I think people have heard maybe vaguely about unsafe working conditions, child labor. What kind of things do we see in the creation of these clothes when it comes to labor?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think the biggest shock is the child labor aspect of it, which is obviously fueled by poverty. Children are being trafficked from their families and told that their children will be schooled and work and send money back to the family. And what happens is the families never see their children again. Some of the statistics are there's 210 million children in forced labor around the world today, and not just in clothing, but in our home goods and chocolate and coffee, our cell phones and all types of technology, mining, dangerous jobs. And just to put that in perspective, last I checked, there's about 250 million people in the United States. So if you can kind of get a grip on what that means, it would be about 4/5 of our population of people doing this slave labor, and nobody really knows about it. So that's definitely an issue. And then, in fact, those child labor jobs are stealing these minimum wage jobs from adults. So it's additionally fueling more poverty there.
Now let's talk about the reaction. Now you and a lot of other people are trying to come up with sustainable alternatives for clothing. Can you give us a taste for the range of things people are trying to do?
Yeah. So I think to do sustainable clothing, I think the first thing is you're voting with your dollar there. And one way would be to abstain. You just only buy what you can use or use what you already have. Hold a swap with your neighbors or your friends, and then repair the items that you've already got to alter and fit better. I think everybody could probably go through their closet and grab a bag full of stuff that they could fix. Another one would be to thrift. Now, you know, this whole fast fashion model is based on impulse shopping, and I think that is why we have thrift stores. So again, thrifting is great, but it also doesn't really change that model of purchasing for us. I would say if you were to get rid of stuff or you were to buy stuff, it's better to do it at faith-based organizations. Usually the administrative salaries are less, and more of that money is actually going right back into local economies. For example, St. Vincent de Paul, Salvation Army, Purple Heart. And I guess another way would be to make things. You still can buy patterns and either have somebody else make it or make it yourself. And if you are planning to shop new, there's a ton of resources online on how to shop ethical, fair trade, recycled, organic, local, independent owned, you know, even just a local boutique rather than a big chain. And the power of the internet is huge. There's a ton of sustainable fashion directories out there. You can follow the brands on Instagram. It's really about seeking out these brands because independent labels have less of a way to get right in your face. And so they really rely on people who are, have that interest to come and find them.
And Vanessa, I'll level with you. I'm probably never going to make my own clothing, and the world will be thankful for that. It wouldn't be pretty. So if as a consumer, I wanted to start to try, I would worry, oh, is this going to be expensive? Is it going to be weird stuff? What would be, for somebody who's not, somebody like me who's never done this before, what would be a good starting point to try to find new sustainable clothing?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a big barrier in the sustainable fashion world is that people think, oh, it's expensive. Oh, it's wonky. It's handmade. It's not sexy. You know, it's tree hugger styles or whatever. I think the best way to get around all that is to just, you know, get in touch with people who are doing something similar like that. First of all, I guess I should say the things that are people are thinking, oh, it's so expensive. But in the reality of it, if you spend maybe a little more on something that's going to last longer, you know, already your dollar is going further. And I think that's one of the biggest barriers for people is that there's some research on sustainable marketing, and essentially nobody wants to spend more money on sustainable clothing. They just don't. So that's kind of one thing that that is difficult for marketing to those people. But if you think about it, right, like it's going to go further. You know, what happened with my business is that it is made to order, so it's essentially a hypothetical business unless somebody were to order something. And as soon as I got to a ground level store, I found that people are just begging me to help them with their alterations and they want custom stuff and they're willing to pay for it, which is pretty amazing. But, again, I think getting things altered secondhand, because people can buy secondhand and then they bring it into me and say, hey, I want these sleeves shortened or this, the shoulders, you know, with taken in and stuff like that. That's a great way for anybody to make something fit them and they love the fabric. They know the fabric's going to last. They love it. They want to change it to make it fit and then they feel good in it. So that's really rewarding.
And I want to talk a little bit more about what you do at Madame Chino. Vanessa, you, as I understand it, your main gig here is taking t-shirts, right? Old t-shirts and turning them into something new. Talk about how you do that.
Yeah, so I started in 2003 just doing all kinds of, you know, switcheroos on stuff. I really got interested in the puzzle piecing back together of cutting up old clothing. And what I found is that it's really hard to market that stuff online because everything is so unique. What I'm doing is I have a made-to-order clothing label. I'm using altered recycled t-shirts. And I'm practicing zero waste. All the scraps are recycled into new fabric via crazy quilting or woven rugs and tapestries. The reason I chose t-shirts is because it's reused fibers, but there's enough consistency in the fabrics that I can kind of promise more than one product. I can create them in volume. So if there were somebody to be like, I want 10 of these in red, I'm able to reproduce that. Whereas with, you know, one-of-a-kind stuff with found object fabrics, you know, I spend a lot of time being like, okay, let me go out and find this and send you 10 pictures and really trying to negotiate with customers about what they want from afar. So this was a way to sort of streamline that process and still be able to reuse textiles.
Now, as a designer and a clothing maker, is this fun? Is this a fun challenge to, in addition to the sustainable benefits, it's just a cool
project.
I
love it. Oh, yeah. Every project is different. And I think, you know, like I said, the gear that I've been driven towards now is a lot more alterations based, just at a local level. And I thought, you know, a lot of artists and designers, they're like, I don't like alterations. I hate doing them. And it's definitely a mindset. It's the same goals that you're reaching with people. You're making them feel good. They feel better in their clothing. You're saving that clothing. You're making it, you know, you're keeping it from the trash or the, you know, wherever else it would end up. So I think I forgot your question, but it's awesome. Yes, I love it. Every day is different. Every project is different. Yeah, they go really fast, and then you get paid because there's already a demand there. Unfortunately, as a producer, you're having to create stuff, and then you don't know when you're going to sell it. So there's more to do there with the marketing end of it.
Well, we'll leave it there, Vanessa. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, absolutely. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Vanessa Andrew, who joined us from a Milwaukee studio earlier today. Vanessa is a Milwaukee artist, community educator, and clothing designer. She creates clothing and textiles and has her own brand, Madame Chino, which she started in 2003. You can find out more about her and her work at madamechino.com. Coming up after news, we'll dig into a new report from the New York Times on workplace discrimination against pregnant women. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in our series of candidate interviews in this month's elections, we'll talk to businessman Jay Schrader. He's the Republican candidate for Secretary of State of Wisconsin. First, the number of mothers working in the U.S. is rising. In the 1970s, only about 47% of American moms were part of the workforce. 3 years ago, that figure had jumped to nearly 70%. That's according to the U.S. Department of Labor. In a series of new reports, the New York Times has been documenting stories of some of those women's experience with pregnancy discrimination in the workplace. Natalie Kitroev covers the economy for the New York Times. Her latest story on this is titled, Miscarrying at Work, the Physical Toll of Pregnancy Discrimination. Natalie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about some of the specific cases you look at and the kinds of discrimination, I want to look at laws on pregnancy discrimination. I think a lot of people might assume that this is pretty well covered in the law, and reading your reporting, it sounds like it really isn't. Can you talk about what's out there?
The only federal law that is explicitly designed to protect pregnant women at work is the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. It is only four paragraphs long, and it's about 40 years old. So what's in there does not compel companies to offer accommodations to pregnant women who ask for them, things like a break from heavy lifting, the ability to carry a water bottle around. It says that companies only have to do that if they are already providing such accommodations for workers who are similarly situated. That means that if a company is not giving anyone a break, is not giving anyone accommodations, they don't necessarily have to do that for pregnant women.
In your reporting, it seems like there's two broad themes of pregnancy discrimination. One is kind of financial impact, women being fired or having career setbacks. We'll get to that in a minute. Your latest piece, though, is on the physical impact and those accommodations you just mentioned. Talk about the kind of stories you came across when it comes to women, pregnant women, who didn't get accommodations in the workplace.
Our investigation identified more than two dozen women who had said that they suffered miscarriages, in one case, a stillborn baby, because they were not given accommodations that they had begged for at work. And these are women doing physical jobs. These are women who are often doing heavy lifting, whether that's in a grocery store, which is one woman we profile, or in a warehouse, which is where we went in Memphis. It was a Verizon warehouse that is operated by a company called XPO Logistics, where workers are lifting huge boxes of iPhones and other tech you know, gadgets. And we found six women who had miscarriages there after they begged supervisors for some sort of a break from that work. And they were not asking for time off, to be clear. They were asking to be moved to sections of the warehouse where they were handling letter boxes or handling paperwork. So this is the most extreme, as you note, physical consequence of pregnancy discrimination.
And in some cases, you document these are women who have come in with notes from their doctors saying, this isn't just a pregnancy, this might be a high-risk pregnancy for one reason or another. So they came in with these notes from their doctors asking for accommodations. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. And to be clear, it's safe for most pregnant women to work while they are carrying, right? These are women who, in almost all the cases, they had high-risk pregnancies, either because they had given birth prematurely before or for other reasons. In many cases, their doctors sent them notes, sometimes multiple notes, urging some sort of a break, accommodations, you know, the ability to carry water around, the ability to sit, lifting restrictions, most importantly. So these were, you know, we talked to doctors who said, you know, ignoring these notes puts our patients at risk.
Tell us a couple of the individual stories you came across at that facility in the Memphis area. That's where you talked to a lot of people as well as looking at legal filings.
So the story of Erica Hayes stands out here. Hers is a story from 2014. She had asked, again, to not lift those boxes weighing 45 pounds each. She wanted to be placed in a section of the warehouse where she handled, you know, sort of envelopes or paperwork for orders, something that didn't require this kind of strenuous work. She was told no, basically because there was a holiday rush in December 2013 that, you know, bled into January 2014. And she was one day at the end of a shift, she rushed to the bathroom. She was bleeding through her jeans, drenching her jeans. She fainted on her way out of the bathroom. She was taken to the hospital in an ambulance where she learned that she had miscarried. We heard from another woman named Chastity B, who had two miscarriages while working at this warehouse, one in 2008 and another one in 2014, that same year, under very similar conditions. She also collapsed to the warehouse floor in the middle of a shift and later learned that she had lost her baby. And these are women who, in all of these cases, both with Erica and Chastity, very, very much wanted their babies. Chastity had bought a baby blanket, you know, for her baby girl, and Erica Hayes was dreaming of raising her kid with her best friend. So it was utterly wrenching.
What did you hear from the employer in these cases?
The employer, XPO Logistics, said, first of all, that they were not running the warehouse in 2014 when some of these incidents happened. There was another woman who had a miscarriage more recently, and there were actually two women who had miscarriages more recently, and there was also a death on the warehouse floor while XPO was running the warehouse. But as to the incidents in 2014, they indicated that those had not been reported to them when they purchased the company that owned the warehouse at the time. They also said that many of the allegations that we made about the warehouse were simply untrue, you know, but they indicated that they would be investigating the more recent events, including the more recent miscarriage.
Talking to Natalie Kittra from the New York Times, she's been reporting on pregnancy discrimination in American workplaces. Staying with the physical side of the concerns related to pregnancy on the job, Natalie, it's not just lifting. In some cases, you talked to women who'd had trouble because they're required to use various chemicals, for example, for cleaning.
We've talked to women both for this most recent story and for a previous story that involved Walmart workers where workers were cleaning with, you know, chemicals that made them feel ill. They asked to please not work with those chemicals. They were not given a permanent break. You know, and one of these women, again, had a health episode that she tied. She carried to term, thank God. But she found herself feeling very unwell and being unaccommodated by Walmart. There are risks for women in a variety of jobs. And again, that's not to say that pregnant women cannot do this work. But in the cases that we've looked at with high-risk pregnancies, they have asked for temporary adjustments to the work that they're doing.
Some people might hear this and say, well, why don't they just find different jobs, I guess, that don't have these kind of risks? How did the women talk about their need for these jobs, you know, especially as they're expecting to start a family with a new kid?
Yeah, they sort of universally needed the paycheck, needed the health care. You know, that's no surprise, right? I mean, the idea that you would just go, you know, and stop working or while you're pregnant, while you're expecting a child is sort of, I think anybody would agree that that's sort of a crazy thought. But more importantly, and I think is the question that you're getting at, what they all said is, to a person, how was I supposed to get a job, a new job, while I was pregnant? You know, they've all described the idea of job hunting while pregnant as being incredibly hard, you know. And they were working, in many cases, low-wage jobs. And you know, they sort of said, how was I going to get Target or Walmart or someone to take a chance on me if I was pregnant? So that was their expectation.
We're talking to Natalie Kitcheroff with the New York Times about her recent piece, Miscarrying at Work, The Physical Toll of Pregnancy Discrimination, part of a series of pieces related to discrimination against pregnant women at workplaces. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced issues like the ones we've been talking about, companies that have or haven't accommodated needs for pregnant women on the workplace? And coming up, we're going to talk about things like salary, promotion, discrimination, or even women being fired because of being pregnant. Is this something you've encountered? If you are an employer, how do you deal with these issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about pregnancy discrimination in the workplace, the impact it has on women's lives, health, and careers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen or encountered discrimination against a pregnant woman, yourself, or someone else at the workplace? Or do you feel like you are with an employer who does a pretty good job of handling these issues? What works? What doesn't? What are your personal experiences? Call 800-642-1234. Natalie Kitcheroff is with us from the New York Times. She's been reporting on this issue, cases of employment discrimination, health risks when women's needs aren't accommodated during high-risk pregnancies. We'll go to your calls now. Katie is with us in New Glarus. Katie, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, what'd you want to tell us about, Katie?
Well, I'm an employment attorney in Wisconsin, and I represent women who are discriminated against in the workplace due to pregnancy, among other things. But one thing that I have observed a few times recently is sort of the reverse of this, where employers refuse to allow women to come to work when they're pregnant because we have employers sometimes who are overzealous at wanting to protect women from themselves. And, you know, they have a doctor's note saying, you know, they're fine, they can lift 50 pounds, they're, you know, and they want to continue being active throughout their pregnancy. An employer who has really made it difficult for them to continue working when they're able to do so, which is another form of discrimination. You know, they are, in Wisconsin, employers are prohibited from not accommodating women with a pregnant restriction.
Got it. Katie, thanks a lot for the call. So, Natalie, did you encounter this? Employers taking things to the opposite extremes and just saying, okay, there are health concerns, we think, we're not going to accommodate, you just can't come to work.
It's interesting. That that predicament is actually an old one, and it's one that led to the passage of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. Partly because companies were doing precisely what Katie describes, and taking a sort of paternalistic approach towards women and denying them opportunities, to do jobs that were seen as dangerous for them. So it definitely goes both ways. What sort of emerges from all of this is that there is a deep sort of cultural issue that employers confront one way or another, which is that they sort of sometimes have trouble sort of conceiving of how to deal with pregnant workers or pregnant job applicants.
Katie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Jennifer on the line in Madison. Jennifer, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Jennifer?
Well, I was let go from my job in my first trimester, and I was looking for a job while I was pregnant. I had quite a few interviews, but as soon as they saw that I was pregnant, even if I was overqualified for the job, I would hear nothing or say, or they would tell me that, oh, we're going in a different direction, you know, the general thanks but no thanks.
And that initial firing, Jennifer, was that, do you think or no, related to your pregnancy?
They never gave me a specific reason that was why they got rid of it, or they let me go. They said that they never received paperwork, and it must have gotten lost in the mail, and that's why they decided to fire me. So, okay.
Gotcha. Jennifer, thanks for the call. And Natalie, this gets toward the other part of your reporting on this pregnancy discrimination issue, not so much the physical concerns, but the career concerns of women. What kind of things, what kind of stories did you hear, like Jennifer's or others?
We heard story after story like Jennifer's, and it's just, to be clear, awful what she experienced. We heard from women who were, if they weren't fired during their pregnancies, they were demoted. If they weren't demoted, they missed out on a raise. When they got back from maternity leave, their salary was cut, or they were sidelined in ways that, may have been subtle to others, but was blatant to them. They were taken off of prestigious assignments. And yes, in the job application process, I mean, to be very clear, this is 100% illegal under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act to consider someone's pregnancy status in a hiring decision. But it still happens. Our interviews have shown that it's so common, you know, you wouldn't believe. Once you start opening these conversations with the women in your life and you ask them, you know, how were you treated, it's not everybody, but you may be surprised to find out just how common that experience is.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for sharing your story. And Natalie, I would think in most cases, of course, an employer isn't going to say we're discriminating against you because of your pregnancy.
Right.
But again and again in the stories you share, yeah, they were pretty blatant about it in some cases.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, you would actually be surprised, because they may not actually say, you know, we're discriminating against you because you're pregnant, but we heard really sort of shocking things. Employers asking, you know, or how are you going to be able to handle this with a kid on the way? You know, you might want to take time off. You may not be so committed when you come back because you're going to have a baby, and you have no idea whether you really are going to want that promotion when you come back. These are all things that women hear, and, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, women that really do want to sort of take time off and take care of their kids. That's one thing. I was hearing this from women who were absolutely thrilled to, you know, wanted to stay on their job tracks, wanted to keep climbing the ladder, and were told these things and sort of saw those hopes diminish in front of their eyes.
Talking to Natalie Kitroff from the New York Times about her reporting on employment discrimination against pregnant women. And yeah, you had one story, Natalie, a six-figure executive. She had arranged childcare starting at 7 a.m. She was full-on committed to doing the job just like she had pre-baby. And yet, what happened?
Yeah, this is Erin Murphy at Glencore, and she was overseeing the movement of oil over there. It's a big commodities trading firm. She had, you know, did everything, or so she thought, she, you know, to sort of stay on track And she was determined after having her kid that she was going to just keep going and barreling ahead. She'd gotten great performance reviews. She was doing well in the eyes of her superiors. But when she came back, she found herself, you know, her boss told her that having a kid would, quote, definitely plateau her career, according to court documents. So, again, those kinds of remarks and the attitude that she says that she faced basically led to a stagnation in her job. And this is someone who, as you said, is a high achiever who was very much committed to staying on the track and says that she was simply pushed to the side after giving birth.
Did I see in your reporting the statistic for people in the same situation, but their new dads, their salary tends to go up on average after a new kid comes along?
Yeah, that's right. Each child takes 6% off of a woman's wages. The same is not true for men. Men who become fathers get a pay bump. And that's in the statistics. We asked social scientists, sociologists who look at this, why that's happening, and they told us there is a feeling among employers that when men become fathers, they need a pay bump because they're taking care of their families. They've sort of become the breadwinners. Of course, that collides with the reality in America that more and more women are serving as breadwinners or co-breadwinners with their husbands.
So looking at all of this, are there efforts to change things, either change the laws or, I guess, change the sociology, the culture going on here?
There is a law that has been, a bill that has been proposed in every congressional session since 2012. It's called the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act that would close the loopholes that that allow some of that, you know, what we talked about initially, the denial of accommodations to pregnant women. It would compel, it would do for pregnant women what the Americans with Disabilities Act does for disabled people. It would require employers to accommodate them as long as it doesn't impose an undue hardship. I don't know, you know, we're waiting for the midterms to happen to see anything in the legislature, but we may see some, we've been hearing that there may be activity on that. And on the culture question, I think it remains to be seen. All I can say is that the response to these stories has been overwhelming, and we have heard more and more that that women and men, women, you know, and their employers are having these conversations. So I guess we'll wait and see.
Yeah. Are there more follow-ups coming up in your reporting just based on what you're hearing from your readers at this point?
Yeah, there are. We have a couple more stories planned, so stay tuned and obviously, you know, keep an eye out for these stories because we can't wait to bring you some of these.
Natalie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Natalie Kitcheroff, economy reporter with the New York Times. She was with us to talk about her reporting a series of reports on various aspects of pregnancy discrimination in the workplace, blue-collar jobs, corporate jobs, and how it impacts women, both their physical health and their financial and career well-being. Do you have a story? You can go over to the New York Times and share it with them, or you can share your thoughts at Central Time WPR on Twitter. You can always email us ideas@WPR.org. Do you have a story related to pregnancy discrimination at the workplace, or do you work for an employer who you think does a pretty good job of dealing with these issues? Again, email ideas@WPR.org, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR.
I knew the core of the sun would be hot, but this is ridiculous.
The core of the sun is really quite hot. Thankfully, we won't have to experience that heat firsthand. But a NASA probe just got closer to it than anything humans have sent out so far. Yesterday, the Parker Solar Probe set a record for the closest a spacecraft has ever gotten to the sun, Close, now as a matter of scale, the previous record was 26.55 million miles from the sun's surface. The Parker probe broke that record, and it's going to get even closer. Eventually, it'll close into 4 million miles, closer than that, though it has a lot of work to get done before then. On the way, it should break another record for the fastest speed traveled relative to the sun at over 150,000 miles an hour. That'll get you a ticket, and not just in Rosendale. Tomorrow, the probe starts its first solar encounter. I'm going to quote here from a NASA release. The spacecraft will face brutal heat and radiation conditions while providing humanity with unprecedentedly close-up observations of a star. And going on, these will add key knowledge to NASA's efforts to understand the sun, where changing conditions can propagate out into the solar system, affecting Earth and other worlds. Okay, so maybe that's why they're doing it, or maybe someone at NASA is just a fan of early Syd Barrett-era Pink Floyd. This is Central Time.
Set the controls for the heart of the sun.